This week, families of Hamas hostages hold on to renewed hope as Israel widens its operations in northern Gaza.
Israel has been bombarding the area for weeks, and the military say Hamas fighters have regrouped there.
When the war finally ends, what does peace look like for Israelis and the Palestinians?
We can't expect anything to change unless the root causes of this conflict are addressed, finally.
And a new UN report finds global emissions moving in the wrong direction as world leaders prepare to attend a major climate summit. Join us on Voice of America as we explore the issues in the news. Hi, everyone. I'm Lori London in Washington. Hamas and Israeli officials are coming closer to a deal to release some of the 240 people held hostage in Gaza and free some Palestinian prisoners held in Israel. This as of Tuesday when this program was recorded. Similar predictions of the hostage agreement in recent weeks have proved premature.
Implementation and execution of an agreement, should one be reached, requires the cooperation of Hamas, a terrorist organization. So it's why we're always hesitant to say too much about what will happen before it has happened. But we are close to an agreement and hopeful one can be reached.
State Department spokesman Matthew Miller. Again, today's program was recorded on Tuesday as I take the next few days off for the Thanksgiving holiday. For the most recent updates, visit voanews.com. As of Tuesday, Israel's army was widening its operations across northern Gaza, where its troops battled Palestinian militants in the densely populated Jabalia refugee camp, the territory's largest. Associated Press correspondent Charles De Ledesma has more.
The Israeli army's expanded operations across northern Gaza, where residents have been without electricity, water, or access to humanitarian aid for weeks. The front line has shifted to the Jabalia camp near Gaza City that houses refugees from the 1948 war surrounding Israel's creation and their descendants. Israel has been bombarding the area for weeks, and the military say Hamas fighters have regrouped there and in other eastern districts after being pushed out of much of Gaza City. I'm Charles De Ledesma.
The war continues to take a horrific toll on thousands of Palestinians who are living in dire conditions, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres.
We are witnessing a killing of civilians that is unparalleled and unprecedented in any conflict since I am Secretary General.
The already grim situation made worse with a lack of medical care.
We are seeing a complete collapse of the higher level infrastructure of the Gazan health system. It is just the most basic of needs that can be met now.
And Michael Ryan, director of Health Emergencies Program at the World Health Organization, says the rain and cold weather in the makeshift camps is creating a breeding ground for illness.
And it is generating all kinds of risks. And it's not just the risks of diarrheal disease. The sudden drop in temperature is going to create a problem with pneumonia in children. The stress that those kids are under, the nutritional status that those children have, make it a recipe for epidemics.
Clearly, people on both sides are suffering. I talked about it with Daniel Sokatch, executive director of the New Israel Fund.
There are a lot of people suffering in Gaza, as you know. And there are also people that are not on the front page anymore, and that would be the survivors, the victims, and the people who love those hostages that want their family members back. What is the organization doing in its efforts to support the victims and survivors?
For Israelis, it's still October 7th. That is very much the lived reality of every day since the Hamas terrorist attacks first occurred. To think about what people murdered on that terrible day, 1,200 people murdered for a country the size of Israel, as many have pointed out, is tens and tens of times bigger than the shock of 9/11 to us here in the U.S., because we have 330 million people and they have under 10 million people. So it's hard for us, I think, to wrap our heads around the unbelievably catastrophic impact that those attacks had on Israelis. And so Israelis sort of, I think, are surprised that the world has moved on. And much of the rest of the world is surprised that Israelis aren't necessarily clocking that there are now according to the Gaza Health Ministry, over 11,000 people killed in Israel's response. So I think that's an important context. As for what NIF is doing, we pivoted very quickly on the 7th and the 8th to understanding that what we needed to do was to provide support, emergency support, in four areas. And the first area is not a place where NIF usually works. We have in the past, there is precedent for that, but this is in the area of humanitarian relief for those most affected by the attacks of the 7th. So already on the 8th, we were working on this response. Because one thing that's important to note is that I use the word catastrophic to describe the impact of the attacks on Israel and Israelis. And it's, in my opinion, it's an apt word, because among the many things that went wrong that day was a catastrophic collapse of the state of Israel's official response. There was obviously a massive intelligence failure. There was a massive security failure, a massive military failure to respond efficiently and quickly to what had happened. 4 out of 5 Israelis lay responsibility for that failure at the feet of Benjamin Netanyahu and his ultra-right-wing coalition government, which failed the people of Israel on that terrible day. But the government continued to fail the people of Israel in the days and weeks following the attack. And that's why New Israel Fund, and by the way, many other civil society groups and organizations, had to step in because of the gap left when it came to relief and rescue efforts for people on the front lines. So NIF's first area of response was sending hundreds of thousands of dollars to support people who had been evacuated from the kibbutzim near the Gaza border, the Bedouin villages, many of which were unrecognized villages. That is to say, villages of Bedouin Arab citizens of Israel that are not recognized by the government of Israel and therefore don't have basic services, including bomb shelters. And Hamas rockets, and it turned out Hamas terrorists, did not discriminate between Jewish and Arab citizens of Israel. They murdered them all. And Bedouin citizens had no place to take shelter from the rockets. So we've been working not only to get relocation assistance, educational assistance to kids who are now far from their homes and in makeshift schools, but also basic medical trauma counseling and security support in the form of mobile bomb shelters for communities that were essentially left to fend for themselves in the days after the terrible attack. And in one instance, people from a development town called Ofakim near the Gaza border were bused to the city of Eilat, evacuated. All the communities near Gaza were evacuated, tens and tens of thousands of people. And they got to Eilat and they were informed, no one informed us you were coming. The government hasn't provided shelter or food or medical care or anything for you. And so someone contacted New Israel Fund from this group of internal refugees, and we literally bought hotel rooms for people who had no place to stay. So we're doing things that we don't usually do because there was this huge gap and so many people were in need. So humanitarian relief was area number one. Number two, we thought a lot about the terrible days in May 2021, after the previous round of fighting between Hamas and Israel, intercommunal violence broke out between Jewish and Arab citizens of Israel in Israeli mixed cities and neighborhoods. And we put in place then Arab-Jewish partnership infrastructure to calm tensions, to work to bring people together, to work with municipal authorities and security authorities to keep community relations open and healthy and positive and mitigate the incitement and violence that always comes during these times. And we have invested deeply in that since 2021. And we put even more support towards these joint Arab-Jewish communal efforts in the wake of October 7th. And thank goodness, to date, we have not seen a repeat of that intercommunal violence, even though tensions are higher than they've ever been before. Third, we see, especially given the nature of the government in Israel, where Netanyahu did bring a more moderate member in Benny Gantz into the Security Council to create more of a national unity government, but he did not kick out the ultra-nationalist ethnic supremacists who he had built this coalition with. And that meant that the rest of the opposition refused to come into the national unity government. And there are still people who have been calling for Israeli Arabs to no longer be equal citizens, to annex the West Bank, to increase the settler population to 1 million Israeli citizens in the West Bank. That's what the foreign minister has called. So Netanyahu didn't jettison those ultra-right-wing ethno-nationalist supremacists from his government. And that means that under the fog of war, there have been many attempts to pass new legislation that would punish people who speak out in protest of Israeli actions in Gaza, who evince sympathy, even showing compassion for innocent suffering in Gaza. So our civil rights organizations have enormous amounts of work to defend cases of people who have been fired from their jobs or expelled from school, and incitement aimed at Arab citizens of Israel, for the most part, by ultra-right wingers. And so we've supported those efforts too. And then finally, we have to look at the day after. And it is not enough to do everything we're doing and to hope that the violence stops soon and that the hostages are released and that the suffering of innocents in Gaza is ended and that Israelis can go back to their homes and Gazans can go back to their homes. We can't expect anything to change unless the root causes of this conflict are addressed, finally. And in order to do that, we are supporting some of the smartest people, Jewish and Arab, thinkers in Israel, to come together to really begin putting forward what an alternative vision of a shared future for Jews and Arabs might look like. We're working with folks on a project that would create policy proposals for a more moderate government, should one ever come to power in Israel, to try to actually return to the negotiation table, to take a different approach to issues of equality between Jewish and Arab citizens of the state of Israel. And so even as we're responding to the immediate humanitarian needs and the civil rights and human rights issues, we're also supporting those Israelis who are looking ahead to the task of not just rebuilding what's been broken, but taking this moment, those Israelis who are saying, look, what got us to this moment is partly what got us to this nightmarish disaster. And we cannot continue this way. The concept that Netanyahu and his government had, that you could sort of manage the relationship with a Hamas in Gaza, which was more interested in ruling than it was in trying to eradicate Israel, that you could do so all the while weakening the Palestinian Authority, which is more moderate, which believes in a two-state solution, by pouring money and people into the settlement enterprise, while at the same time integrating into the region and making peace with the Gulf states and maybe even Saudi Arabia. This has been shown to be the dead end and the illusion that it is. And now people of goodwill who care about the people who live in the region, Israelis and Palestinians alike, need to become serious about figuring out how to get back to a meaningful and serious process of negotiating some kind of diplomatic political settlement, one that obviously the rulers of Hamas and the current extremists in the Israeli government are not going to be the people to realize, but that smart Israelis and compassionate Israelis and Palestinians will understand is the only way forward.
I'm wondering also where you stand as far as Israel's response in Gaza, and there are obviously a lot of innocent people there getting killed. Do you see this as a necessary situation or not necessarily the right way to ultimately get peace?
Well, look, I'm not a military strategist, but what I will say is that whether you're Israel or the United States or the UK or Japan, if you're a country that has signed the Fourth Geneva Conventions, if you're a country that has adopted formally or informally the notion that there are international rules of war and humanitarian law, and you have put yourself on the side of those parts of the world that say, no, you know, might doesn't make right. We, after World War II, the world came together and agreed on a set of aspirational ideas that were meant to guide the way people went to war. This kind of sounds crazy to people, but there you go, because they realized that without that, we would have repeats of all hell breaking loose as it did in World War II. And so even a country that is pursuing a just war, and it seems to me, from my vantage point, that the idea of ensuring that Hamas can't do what it did on October 7th again to Israeli citizens, to innocent people, is a primary responsibility of the government of Israel. But even in the pursuit of a just war, whether it's after October 7th or 9/11, two things pertain. One, in my opinion, you must pursue even a just war cause within the boundaries of what international law, humanitarian law, and the rules of law of war prescribe. You don't have the right to break those rules and standards just because it happened to be your country that was attacked. So this is a tough thing for a lot of people to swallow, but, you know, like I said, it applied to the U.S. after 9/11, and it applies to Israel now. We all agreed as civilized peoples in the world that we were going to conduct ourselves in a certain way or else chaos follows. And so Israel must conduct this war in accordance with those rules of war and international humanitarian law. The second point I would make is that whatever happens now, without addressing what I spoke about a moment moment ago, the day after, without looking at the root causes of why Israel and Gaza, Palestinians and Israelis found themselves where they found themselves on October 7th, this is all in vain. Because unless we go and untangle and try to rebuild some kind of political diplomatic solution, this will just be the latest in a horrific ongoing cycle of violence that extremists on all sides have pushed forward, leaving sort of moderates helpless in their wake. And people have to understand that there will not be a military solution, neither for Hamas nor for Israel, in resolving the conflict that exists today. Only a political diplomatic solution will get us out of the horrific mess that we're in.
And how concerned are you and how surprised are you at the level of what appears to be a rise in anti-Semitism across the U.S. and even around the world since this terrible assault on Israel on October 7th?
Well, it's very worrying. And, you know, as I say to my own kids, if you find yourself talking to someone who is rationalizing, justifying, ignoring, or God forbid, mocking or celebrating the slaughter of innocent people, then there's something deeply broken when it comes to the moral compass of that person. And by the way, that is true of families huddled in the safe rooms of their kibbutz near Gaza, or families huddled in terror in a high rise in Gaza City. If we can dismiss those people as at best collateral damage and at worst somehow deserving of their fate, then I think there's a horrific problem with our humanity. And what we've seen in some quarters is the dismissal of the humanity of those Israelis, not all of whom were Jewish, by the way, who were slaughtered or captured and stolen and kidnapped to Gaza on October 7th. What was shocking for people like me is that I always assumed that the folks who are either ignoring or rationalizing or celebrating what happened to Israelis, before this, we thought, well, they may not like Israel, but ultimately they believe in human rights, in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, in humanitarian law. And they would condemn this kind of monstrosity if it happened to anybody. And it turned out not when it happened to Israelis. And I think that there are a lot of reasons for that, but a lot of those reasons take us to a place where those people were either unknowingly or quite knowingly acting in an anti-Semitic way. If Jews are the only people who deserve that kind of treatment, if they're the only people who don't deserve to have a nation state, if they're the only people whose slaughter, the slaughter of innocent civilians, can be rationalized or justified, then there's something deeply, deeply broken in that response.
Daniel Sokatch, Executive Director of the New Israel Fund, thank you so much. You're listening to Issues in the News. I'm Lori London. The world is heading for a temperature rise far above the Paris Agreement goals unless countries deliver more than they've promised. This, according to the UN Environment Program's Emissions Gap Report 2023, Ilan Rubens with Reuters has more.
The world is on track to warm by nearly 3 degrees Celsius this century. That's according to a new United Nations analysis released ahead of the COP28 climate summit in the United Arab Emirates. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres.
The report shows that the emissions gap is more like an emissions canyon.
The annual emissions gap report assesses countries' promises to tackle climate change compared with what is needed. Anne Olhoff is the chief scientific editor of this report.
Based on what countries are doing right now, if they continue the current efforts of climate mitigation, then we're looking at limiting temperature increase to 3 degrees throughout this century. With the climate promises for 2030, we're looking at an increase of between 2.5 and 2.9 degrees Celsius. So that's a massive global warming.
At 3 degrees Celsius of warming, scientists predict the world could pass several catastrophic points of no return, from the runaway melting of ice sheets to the Amazon rainforest dying out.
We will see maybe 10 times as many extreme weather events in terms of extreme temperatures. We will see more heavy precipitation. And of course, there are lots of damages following, such as wildfires and so forth.
World leaders will soon meet in Dubai for the COP28 summit, with the aim of keeping the Paris Agreement warming target of 1.5 degrees Celsius alive. But the new UN report does little to inspire hope that this goal remains in reach. It found that greenhouse gas emissions must fall by 42% by 2030 to hold warming at 1.5 5 degrees Celsius. But global emissions actually rose by more than 1% between 2021 and 2022, reaching a record 57.4 gigatons of carbon dioxide equivalent.
We must reverse course.
As we just heard, the latest worrisome climate report comes ahead of next week's start of the COP28 conference in Dubai, where world leaders from nearly 200 countries will meet to discuss stronger climate action. As scientists warn, there is no time to spare.
Governments can't keep pledging to cut emissions under the Paris Agreement and then greenlighting huge fossil fuel projects. This is throwing the global energy transition and humanity's future into question.
Ingar Andersen, Executive Director of the UN's Environment Program. Joining me to talk about the main points of focus at the conference and whether this year could see deeper commitments followed by action is Nathan Cogswell, Research Associate with the World Resource Institute.
It appears to be a pretty steep road ahead to get everyone on the same page with world leaders when it comes to investing in what needs to happen. What do you see as really the main agenda for the upcoming summit?
I think first, COP28, the upcoming conference in Dubai, offers a historic opportunity to course correct and to demonstrate commitment to addressing climate change. And the reason I mentioned historic opportunity is that this COP will be the first what we call global stocktake, a process underneath the Paris Agreement to assess collective progress towards the agreement's goals and to chart a path forward to deliver sort of that rapid response to the crisis. And so this year at the COP is the first opportunity, is the first global stocktake, and really provides that opportunity. There are a couple of different areas where there are significant opportunities in particular, one being on resilience and addressing the climate impacts and preparing communities and supporting communities in responding to those impacts. Another is on fossil fuels and the energy transition and rapidly shifting away from fossil fuels to renewable energy, to energy efficiency and fossil-free transport. And then the third area, I would say, is on food and transforming food and land use systems and the ways in which countries think about protecting forests and ecosystems.
When you mention these three things, are you talking about actual commitments or plans of action? How does that look?
So to take the example first on resilience, on adaptation and loss and damage. Last year at COP27, conference held in Egypt in November 2022, countries agreed to establish funding arrangements, including a fund for addressing what we call loss and damage. And these are the impacts from climate change that cannot be adapted to. And so the task this year for countries at the conference is to agree on how to operationalize that fund, how to ensure that finance is new, additional, and flows to those local communities who need it. So that's one example on resilience. On fossil fuels, there has been a lot of discussion recently in the UN climate process, but also the broader climate policy debate about expanding renewables. And so at the conference this year, we could see countries agree to tripling renewable energy, to doubling energy efficiency, to rapidly shifting away from fossil fuels and decreasing investments, public support, and subsidies for fossil fuels. And on the food example, the COP28 presidency led by the UAE is planning to release a bold declaration, which is meant to outline a commitment to incorporate food into climate plans, to identify ways to transform the food systems, and deliver finance and support for countries and communities and people to do so.
And is there any kind of accountability with all of these commitments? How does that work as far as actually following through?
Great question. And some of these commitments, especially these commitments that will be negotiated as part of the formal intergovernmental negotiations, carry great weight. Those are things that countries all agree through the formal legal negotiation process that they would agree to. And so particularly there, we're expecting negotiated outcomes on loss and damage and on the questions around energy. And on the example on food, the declaration that's being led by the UAE, it's important that we continue to follow up, that leaders, you know, begin to think about how to set out action plans, how to deliver on that commitment, and that there's effort given to return to that in future years and ensure transparency of progress and ensure accountability in meeting those targets.
And do you think that anything has changed with all these extreme weather events and, of course, extreme heat? Do you think there is a growing sense of urgency for following through now?
I think the sense of urgency grows each day, each year. There's been an urgent need for action for many years and since the establishment of the UN climate process. And I think that continues to grow each and every year. The UN climate process is there to support governments and to support international cooperation among them. But ultimately, we are relying on governments and leaders and communities and businesses to take the steps necessary to make the investments that are needed to address climate change.
Nathan Cogswell, Research Associate with the World Resource Institute. And that's all the time we have this week. On behalf of all of us here at VOA, thank you so much for listening. Join us next week for more Issues in the News. Until next time, I'm VOA's Lori London.